Maxine Ray conducting an interview for the Civil Rights Project, sponsored by the Kentucky Oral History Commission, Kentucky Historical Society. I am interviewing Mr. Ron Lewis at his home here in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Today's date is June the 20th, 2001. Now, Mr. Lewis, can you give me your full name, please?
My name is Ronald D. Lewis. I generally go by Ron Lewis.
What's your date of birth, please?
December the 3rd, 1948.
What's your parents' name?
Mr. and Mrs. James W. Lewis, Sr.
Okay. How long have you lived in Bowling Green?
I've lived here since 1966. That was the year I came to attend Western, and then I raised my family. I met my wife, raised my family, been living here ever since.
What's your occupation?
I'm a teacher. I've been teaching now for 31 years at Bowling Green Junior High School. I've taught some of a couple of years at the high school.
What classes do you teach, or what grade level do you teach?
Okay, the junior high has been 7th, 8th, and 9th grade levels. Generally 2 years, like 6th and 7th, 7th and 8th, or 8th and 9th. And this year it's 7th and 8th. Next year it'll switch to 6th, 7th, and 8th.
When you first started teaching at junior high school, were the classes integrated?
Yes.
Were already started?
Yes. All the classes were integrated. And now, to what degree, I'm not totally sure. But there was, some degree of integration.
Of course, when you started at junior high, did you face any kind of racism or anything through other teachers or through the administration?
I don't remember as much through the administration. I do remember there being some racism from some of the staff, some of the students, more than anything else. There wasn't a great deal of racism, but some of it was subtle. There was very little overt racism from the fact that there were some subtle forms of racism. And with the kids, there was a little, but I think most of that was due to ignorance or their lack of interaction with blacks.
Okay, now, where did you live before you came to Bowling Green?
I'm originally from Bardstown, Kentucky. And as I said earlier, I came to Western in 1966.
Well, okay, during your earlier school years in Bardstown, were the schools integrated there?
Not initially.
Uh-huh.
I attended predominantly, it was all black school, Bardstown Training, through my seventh grade year. And our class was the last seventh grade to graduate from Bardstown Training. They had integrated the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th about 2 or 3 years earlier, maybe about 4 years earlier, because my oldest brother, he was the last senior graduating class from Bardstown Training, and I was trying to think how many years he is older than I am, 2, 4, 7, he's 7 years older than I am, so that was the year that they actually, or the year after that, they integrated.
Can you think of any type of overt racism that you faced during your years in Bardstown, your elementary years, at the stores or libraries?
Oh, yes. It was very clear. As a matter of fact, there was the picture show. There was a balcony, and that's the only place we were allowed to watch the movies. Down below, the whites attended in a larger section. And stores uptown, the drugstore and the ice cream parlor, you could go in and order, but you could not sit down. And then I remember after a lot of the civil rights movement and integration and so on, we were allowed to go in, but in the back of our mind, we hesitated going in. Now, some of us decided, well, we're going to take a chance on this. And we did go in and sat down. We did receive a few stares. I don't remember anything verbal once we did sit down. I believe the town more or less accepted what was going on then. And some of the race relationships back there were pretty good. The community I lived in, of course, there were several sections of town in Bardstown where blacks predominantly lived. And the areas between where the black neighborhood ended and the white neighborhood took over, many times I lived on those fringe areas. And so I did have some friends who were white. And we got along pretty well. Of course, there were some, you know, disagreements. But by and large, the relationship was there. It was pretty good. Pretty good. When I came to Bowling Green, I don't know, I had a feeling that at the time, and of course, Bardstown's a small area, that I had gone back in time to some degree. But with Western and the other part of the community, it grew and changed.
Did you all have any, in Bardstown, did you have any kind of marches? Did the Klan ever march in your city, or did y'all do any kind of protests?
There were no Klan marches that I remember. As a matter of fact, I don't even remember any demonstrations for the civil rights movement, except the time when we went to Frankfort. I say we, I didn't go that day, but there were a group of individuals that left Bardstown that went to Frankfort for that march. And I was trying to think of whether I was asked to go or whether I had intended to go, but I did not. But I regretted not going to the march on Frankfort. But I don't remember any civil rights marches there in Bardstown.
Okay, this community that you live in now here in Bowling Green, when you moved in, was it predominantly one race community, or was it a mixed?
This area out here, it was mixed. Of course, on two sides of me were neighbors who were black, and on two sides were neighbors who were white, and we got along really well. We were accepted. Of course, the neighborhood itself had been integrated years before, and I didn't experience any racial problems that I know of. No shouting or no writing walls or damaging property that I know of.
Okay, when you came to Western, how about race relations there? Did you meet any obstacles when you were going to Western?
Yeah, there were some. I remember going in and eating in a couple of places that we received a number of stares. And of course, at that time, we took, it was our understanding that all the places were open. But when we went in, some of the service in some of the establishments were seemed less, I guess, receptive than others. But there were a few places where we received equal treatment, or we felt like there weren't any differences made. Up on Western's campus, now that was a little more open, I think, because people were from different areas and were maybe a little more accustomed to meeting people from different backgrounds.
Do you belong to any kind of civil rights organizations or any civil organizations?
Yes, I've been a member of the NAACP for several years, and ever since the charter was reinstated back here in Bowling Green. At one time, I understand, before I was here, and this is through Dr. Moxley, Selwyn Butts, and some others who lived here, that there was an NAACP chapter back here probably in the early 20s, if I'm not mistaken, or sometime around there. And then for some reason the chapter went out, but it was re-chartered in the early 70s.
Now, we don't have a chapter now, do we?
Not an active chapter, no. The office actually closed down 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken. And I guess due to less involvement, and some of it was apathy, and you know, the people, they did not see some issues. They saw some changes occurring, and I think most of the people thought we have arrived. But you know, I disagree with that, and I was sorry to see that the chapter closed. But at the time, you know, I didn't have as much time to devote to it, and some of the others didn't as well.
Did you hold any office in the NAACP?
Yes. I was president of the Bowling Warren County NAACP. I was initially, when we were rechartered, the strategy was to, and when we met at Taylor Chapel Church and State Street Church and Mount Zion, that I remember, on a rotating basis. And the strategy was that someone would chair. We didn't really have a president. And we rotated the chairmanship of that committee from, I believe it was month to month. The strategy was that in the past, the reason the president or chairperson did not continue was pressure was brought on. The forces that be of racism would zero in on this person, either through their job or economics or some type of political pressure, and cause them to leave. And we felt like if that were the case, then if you rotated the leadership, you would not give those forces of racism a chance to concentrate on one person. They had to deal with an entire community. And so we rotated around, and I think I was the third, I guess, potential chairperson as we rotated. And after that time, after a couple of rotations, we felt like it was time to establish a president. And if I'm not mistaken, I think I was the first elected president after we were recharged, if I'm not mistaken.
Can you remember any particular issue that you all faced, or any problem that you all, that the NAACP faced?
Yes. Initially, we were lacking in funds, and we wanted to address some problems in housing, in employment, and in education. Those were our main thrusts. And at that particular time, there was information on affirmative action. And that was our initial thrust to bring affirmative action to Bowling Green. And we went through some changes there because we had to educate the city of Bowling Green, because the city officials were unaware as to really what affirmative action was. And so was a lot of the community. And many of the people that we dealt with, and we met with officials from the city, and they were under the impression that affirmative action was just quotas. And we said it's more than that. It's a force to bring equality in education and employment and housing and in other areas by taking some positive and forceful directives. And we tried to educate them on the fact that quotas were only brought in after an entity like a government or an agency or a company failed to actually implement their equal opportunity programs, or they made little effort. And after they had been given the opportunity, then the courts actually ordered quotas. And that's where the term quota would be made to do this, that, and the other. But many of them had the wrong impression. Again, affirmative action, they thought that you just had to put a minority in that area, whether they qualified or not. And that was another downfall. And that was one reason why affirmative action did not go well, and it got a bad reputation. Some communities did not understand affirmative action, and they put minorities in those areas strictly because they were minorities, but not because they were qualified to do the work. Now, another organization that I belonged to was, I was a member of the Human Rights Commission as well, and served on the Human Rights Commission for several years. I was interim chairperson during a time that they needed a director. And I served on a couple of committees, and one committee in particular was housing. And I chaired that committee. Now, I also worked some in employment and some in education, but primarily I worked on the housing committee. And that was through some personal experiences I had concerning racism. My wife and I, we saw places to live. And I guess sometimes you assume the world is changing, and yet it's not. And I believe at that time we thought some of the old vestiges of racism had been removed, until we tried to rent some property. And at the time we couldn't afford it, and neither of us had a permanent job at the time. But we tried to rent some property, and that was, I guess, part of our first awakening that racism was still alive and prominent. And some of the excuses that people gave, and most of these we were able to call to just see if the property was available. And some people were, I say ignorant, but some people were just that bold to say, "Are you black?" On the phone. And of course, I wasn't going to deny who or what I was. I would say yes, and sometimes the phone would click then. One place we called, and everything was fine, the rent, the accommodations and everything. But then when it got to who we were, we said, "Yeah, we're black." And they said, "Well, we can't rent to you." And I said, "Well, tell me why." And this lady said, "Well, because I had a black mammy, and she was very demanding and so on." And I said, "But you don't know me." "But no, we can't rent to you." And so we experienced several things like this. But the one that stands out in my mind initially was we went to see some property up in Plum Springs. And everything was fine over the phone. Race never did come up. When we pulled into the place, we were waiting, and the property owner drove up. And as a matter of fact, he told us that he didn't actually, wasn't the only owner. There were several other people involved, but he was a representative, and he handled the renting of the property. So when we drove up, he looked at us, and we got this unusual stare, as if to say, "You all are black." Which my wife and I, you know, we had become accustomed by this time. And this was maybe about the third or fourth incident where we'd been denied property. But at that time, we were talking, and we wanted to see the house, and he wouldn't even show us the house. He said, "Now, you all need to go back into Bowling Green and find some property there." Well, my wife, she's normally a calm person, but this was a straw that broke the camel's back. He said, "Well, I'll rent it to you, but for an extra, I think it was an extra $100 or $75 during that time." And the rent for the place was only going to be $125, so this was about like $225. And my wife said, "Before I rent it, I burned the place down." I said, "Oh, honey, don't say that." I had to hold her back, because she was very upset, and I can understand. I said, "No." I said, "That's all right." I said, "We'll take care of this." I said, "We'll take care of this." And I said, but you're not renting to us because we're black. And he said, yes. He said, that's the reason why. He said, but if you all pay the extra amount, he said, you can. He said, but we'd have all type of cars out here. And I mean, that blew my mind because we only had one car then. But and nevertheless, it showed some of the evidence. But anyway, I went back home and I was angry and upset, but I was trying to maintain some objectivity to myself. So I started writing down the incidents, the whole incident, documenting it. Something in the back of my mind told me that here this was at least the fourth situation, and I was tired of being confronted with it. So I wrote it up, and at that time, I don't think there was an active chapter of the Human Rights Commission here. There was. But the lady, there was one person, I think Mrs. Denny was the director, but she was there, and I'm not even sure if she had a secretary. So I turned in the complaint to her and got the article out of the newspaper where it had advertised it for a certain amount and did all that. And she said, well, she said, we're not equipped to do an investigation or anything here. So she said, I'm going to forward it on to the State Human Rights Commission. So she did. And they sent an investigator out, talked with me, and so on, and various other things that went on in the investigative process. And in the end, we were allowed to rent the house if we wanted it. And at that time, we had our first child, and winter was coming on. And not knowing what we were going to face, we said, no, we didn't want to face the possibility of being out there, the heat off or something, and then the landlord not taking care of us. So we didn't feel good about it. So there was a small monetary agreement, and then we, you know, in the meantime found another place to rent. But that initially got me a little more involved in the civil rights process and with the Human Rights Commission. Like I say, at the time, I was already a member of the NAACP, but I had been very active.
Oh, very interesting, very interesting.
There were some other stories, too, but by and large, that's the way it was. But, you know, over the years, I've seen bouldering change.
Do you think it's changed for the better, or are we still on the...
I think it has changed for the better, and I would say there are several things, of course. Seems like the, and I believe Bowling Green integrated after Bardstown, and that's why when some of the difficulties arose during the, I would say, late 60s, early 70s, it surprised me, and then I thought that the communities were over that, but still, there was a significant amount of progress, and I think the fact that the community accepted integration. I believe the force at Western was here. We had some active community leaders who were interested in making the community better, black and white. And I think with the influx of the GM plant, I think was significant in the area of housing and employment for a couple of reasons. One, some of the blacks were not able to buy some of the property because of the price range and so on. Others were steered by some of the realtors, and there's some racism involved in that too. But I think then too, the community, and not just the black community, but the white community, the vision I saw was many of them felt comfortable in the community where they were, whether it was black or white, and there wasn't an immediate need to go out to try to integrate. And there were, some families that lived in integrated neighborhoods here, and they got along well. But by and large, the community did not. And I think when the GM people came in, many of them, black and white, pretty much bought where they wanted to be. And I think that was an initial thrust. And I think all of those things, and there may have been some others that affected to Bowling Green to change. I think Bowling Green grew up and accepted the idea of integration and a diverse community and saw it good for economic reasons as well. And like I said, initially when I came to Bowling Green, I said 4 years, I get my degree, I'm gone. But here I am. Since 66, Bowling Green grows on you. It's changed for the better. I've raised my family, and I intend to live here. So it's been good.
Well, that's all the questions I have. Do you have anything else you want to add that I haven't asked?
Well, I would say, just like the civil rights movement across the nation, the churches were a key part and provided some leadership and direction for the human right, for the civil rights movement. There were a few white members who took the lead, and I'm very proud to know some of them and work with them. They were very open. Hank Totino was one, and I just mentioned him. There were several. But there were several people who put their lives on the line, their reputation, friendship, because I'm sure they were criticized by some with working with the blacks and so on. I remember there was a meeting of some concerned citizens, black and white. Mr. George Esters, Reverend Esters, met down, I think, at 3rd and State Street. For a time, and there was a teacher at Western that I remember who was white, who taught, and I'm not sure whether it was the physics or science department, Dr. Holley. He and his wife were very instrumental in getting the Human Rights Commission established here, and opening up part of the community for what I felt were outsiders, whether they be from another area or whether they be black or whatever. But they were some people whose names we were given initially that if we had problems to contact them. And I think some of the efforts of Western helped to open up the community as well. Now when I say open up the community, I think, and then this is just my perception, the old boy network, good old boy network, was in place, and tradition and conservative atmosphere was more or less prevalent throughout some parts of Western as well, because we'd seen the Dixie flag. And it meant something different to me than it did from some other people. I remember there were some college students from Alabama who came, and of course Weston used to play Dixie and wave the flag when we'd make a touchdown. Well, we wouldn't stand. Some of us, the majority of black students, wouldn't stand. Well, this other person from Mississippi got up and stood and couldn't understand why we felt the way we did, and we explain to them about our feelings about what the flag stood for, slavery, some of the tragedies that occurred. Now, during that time, we're well aware that everything with the South was not bad. As a matter of fact, some things in the South were better than in the North, and racism did occur there, but overt racism was more in the South, and covert racism more in the North. It was hidden. And but after explaining that, I think that and expressing our desire that the flags come down and Dixie not be sung was very important. I think Howard Bailey and some of the other concerned students there, Don Offit, who were up on the campus at the time, went and talked with some of the administration and expressed our concern and our sensitivity about this issue, and I think they began to filter down. Dr. Thompson and Dr. D.R.O. Downing seemed receptive to that, and now some of the other presidents, I don't know, I didn't have any. About my experience at Western, the integration there took place slowly too, and I was a part of a, I guess, a movement to get a black fraternity up on the hill. And many of the blacks that were up there were interested in forming a fraternity, but they were drawn between two, the Kappas and the Qs, and the or Omegas. And but I guess in our own wisdom, we realized we couldn't do it by ourselves, so we combined together and formed the Kappa Q Club. And initially, we were trying to get a fraternity on campus. We didn't care really which one went in. We'd like for both, but we said which one would go. So we did band together and addressed the administration and went through some changes. And shortly after that, I got married. So my interest in a fraternity sort of dwindled. But I supported some of the others who continue on, and like say Don Offit and Howard Bailey were some of the initial leaders in that particular group. There were some others as well, but John Potter, Omri, Joseph Omri, and some others. There were others, and if I start naming a few, I'll probably forget, but they were some. And they approached the administration and eventually got the right to have a fraternity on campus. But that was some of the beginning, people up there. And I think with that, Western began to make a change. It was a little more diverse. Of course, they always had an international club up there, but generally didn't include the blacks. I mean, there were blacks from Africa and so on, but they didn't consider them, blacks associated with the United States. Or that was seen as totally different. But that was interesting too, going through some of the things up there. There were very few faculty members who were black up there. As I remember, there were only, I think, three or four when I started. Of course, Dr. Jones was up there, Dr. Yokley. There was a doctor in psychology, and I can't think of his name right off. And there was another one, I think, who taught home economics. But those two left later on and went to other universities. And then after that, it seemed like there were some other blacks that were added to the faculty slowly. And now they have, I think, a fair amount and some in administration. And Western has integrated or accepted that over the years. I think Bowling Green with Western, with the economy, with the GM plant, with the influx of people, and not only that, internally, I think the people of Bowling Green who lived here, many of the blacks wanted to see some changes. Speaking of that, I know with your experience with Jones. And I remember when Jonesville was there, and I remember going to church over at Mount Zion, and going through the neighborhood back over during that time. And I wasn't fully aware as to what was happening. You know, then, you know, later on I was enlightened, but I didn't realize that some of the property was acquired like it was, and in the way that it was. And that saddens me now. At the time, I guess my ignorance, there's another term I was going to use to describe too, saw it as maybe progress or whatever, but I wasn't fully aware as to what was happening in the communities that were being lost. And since then, I've listened to your interview, talked to some people who lived there, and found out the total truth about it. And I think Western has made some steps to recognize and compensate it, but I don't believe they've done enough. I still think there's some things. It would be good if Western established Jonesville Scholarship Fund on their own in funding. I mean, that would be the least, I would think. And there are several of us who are Western graduates, you know, who would support that. And I wouldn't think it would be guilt money, but I think it would be the right thing to do for Western. And many of the people, I think, who probably had the idea or directed that, probably had the thought of just making way for our community, not caring who we were in the way, or saw maybe some people they thought were powerless. But in reality, the people who live there have to make Bowling Green really what it is. You know, a lot of people. But there are some thoughts on that.
Well, I want to thank you for your time and for
okay.
the interview.
Okay, this aisle here keeps running and running and running. I don't know what it is. I hope I gave you some accurate facts. And best of my recollection, of course, over time, sometimes you forget some things or don't see things quite as they are. Or sometimes you get a little bit better picture. But I don't know. I hope that gave you some information. Tried to remember it as accurately as I could.
Good.
So, if I think of anything else, maybe I'll give you a call or add to it, or if I find when I go through some of those papers, I can give you some maybe some specific dates and times that are served, because
I've
done a little resume to try to get some of that information, and some of the people who were involved. So I hope that will help out some and enlighten some of as well. You know, when I came to Western, like I say, there were no blacks in administration, and only, I think, about three staff members who taught. But the majority of the other blacks were, they were in the maintenance, and I remember Mr. Woods being in cook over there and serving at the log cabin, and they were in the cleaning staff of the university, but then they were limited in, seemed like, some of the areas that they could work in. But that was something, you know, you perceive as you go in, you see where the blacks are and what levels they're in. Now, I think Howard Bailey was one of the first administrators, black administrators, to be at Western, if not the first. And that's my perception as I saw it. And an interesting thing as a student, and this was when Howard came, because I think the year that I came in 66, there were a number of blacks who took advantage of them. There was the National Defense Loan. It was an opportunity to go to college and borrow the money and then pay it back. And I know there were a number of students from Lloyd. And the only reason I found out about it was I was a member of the Key Club. And of course, I was the only black at home in the Key Club. And there was a speaker who happened to be at the Key Club speaking. And he was informing these members, who were all white except myself, about the National Defense Loan Program. And I had not initially thought of going to school because, you know, there was no way. Mom and Dad couldn't afford it. I didn't have a job. As I said, my other brothers had gone to the military. And I thought, well, maybe I could go and then get on the GI Bill. Well, had I not been at that meeting, I would not have found out about this, because the, quote, counselor at the school was a counselor, but only for the elite and the white. When we, the blacks, went to ask him some questions, he was very sharp, to the point, and or very little information was given to us that we felt. Now, you know, perception can be part of it too. But I shared that with a couple of other people who then made applications as well. And I think there were three or four of the blacks from my school who came here on the National Defense Loan. And I wouldn't take full credit for saying that I told them about it, but I did make them aware of some things I found out about it. So initially, you know, that was the way to get here. And during that time, we talked with some people. Yes, the counselors don't really guide a lot of the black kids like they do some of the others. And one thing that I found out with my kids was that we told them not to depend on anyone else but themselves. Now, they should go and inquire and try to find out some information. But some of them were limited in what information they would give you. And so we heard some horror stories when this was as we started to go out and visit some of the universities about getting in their scholarship information and so on. Some counselors had inadvertently, or maybe on purpose, had failed to mail in the information and on time, and some of them missed the deadline, so we made sure that ever what was going in, we would handle. So if it was anybody's fault, it was our own. Do not depend on the counselors. And like I say, I'm not sure how much counseling actually goes on out here. Some are interested in the kids going to college, but I'm not so sure a number of our kids, some number of the black kids, actually get some of the guidance that they need in helping to select the university or wherever they might attend, the business school, vocational school, whatever that they get. And that may be typical of the guidance program. And I know there's a couple of teachers out there who are trying to work with the black kids. Beverly Brown is one. Of course, this is now. It's not then. Before, like I said, there were no black counselors at all. I think there's one now. This is Rowan. And, but, you know, she can't do it all by herself. And then she's only working with 1/4 of the classes out there. And I don't know what pressures might be on her, you know, to assist the kids that are, quote, going somewhere from somebody who's known. But let me jump back a little bit on Western. With blacks that came that year, there were a number of us living in the dormitories. And because as far as living off campus, the only ones that I knew that lived off campus lived with black families. And we were the first group that lived in the Barnes Campbell Bemis Lawrence buildings. They were new there. They were some of the new dormitories. And it was a spring day, and at the time we were hanging out the windows, and all of a sudden we happened to look up, and all the guys were, and these were boys' dorms, all the boys were hanging out the window because it was such a nice day. And we noticed right above us there were some blacks above us, and then above us and above us, and we looked below us, there were blacks hanging out the window, but on the right and left they were all white. And there was this pattern. We lived in 309 Barnes Campbell, but in 209 and on up, they were all black. There was one guy who was black and a white who was in, I think, 409 above us, but the rest were black all the way up. Now, then, there were a few blacks in some other parts of the building, but this was one thing we noticed right off, and it was too much to be coincidental. Part of that had to have been planned. I mean, no matter what, we never did really ask, but I mean, it was very evident with all of us in that 09 area that that's where it was. And that was one thing I remember now. Who was in charge of that? I don't know. But that was in Barnes Campbell. Now, Bemis Lawrence, I'm not sure how they were, but Barnes Campbell, I do remember that one day. And it was like a light going off, and all of us realizing, hey, wait a minute, all the blacks are in line here. Now, there were a few other blacks in other parts, but I guess that was some of the racism then. And I'm not sure why it was set up like that. But on the application, they did ask what your racial background was. And I do know the housing was set up through the housing department. Now, after that, I think 3 years later, they had a black dorm director, one of the first ones, Ed Goins. I think he's in Louisville. And, but by then, it seems like the blacks were scattered, at least I know from the men's dormitory. And I lived in Betts Village to watch, you know, some of the buildings go up. But it was amazing that day that we saw that, and we never did really address it. I guess we accepted it more than anything else. But that was an interesting thing that occurred there. And, some of the racism that was sure existed. Now, some of the people, some of the students, were very open, and then some of the faculty accepted us. But I do remember one faculty member I had for a class. It was an education class. And I was writing a paper on integration. And I had misspelled it. And misspelled integration. And he made it a point in class to say, now he didn't direct me out, but he could tell it was racism coming out. He said, yes, some people want integration, cannot even spell it right. I knew what he was talking about. And that was my haste in not checking my paper. But better believe, every time after that, I checked it. And I felt like we were zero again. Of course, there weren't too many blacks on campus with the number of students that attended there. It was less than 10% easily. But we did get together, and we communicated with some of the blacks locally who went up there, and they kept us informed about the community, you know, and things like that, where we could go. But that's been something. I remember, and this is after I got out of Western, black friends and I had gone to a couple of, I guess, the nightclubs. With some white friends, and everything seemed all right. And again, I guess I assumed everything had arrived. So this black couple and my wife and I went out. So I said, why don't we go to, I think it was then, Manhattan Towers. We were going to get dinner and, you know, maybe have a little drink, then dance and so on. So we went out there. And as we walked in, the arm went across the door. Place is full. I looked in, there were a bunch of chairs that were not. And I said, no, I said, they're, so he said, they're reserved. And so the friend who was with us, he said, no. He said, I sort of figured this would happen. He said, no, let's go. We don't want any trouble. Let's go. And that made me aware that things, you know, had not fully changed. I could have fought it. I didn't initially, but I did not go back in that place at all, not even with my friends. And some of my white friends asked, and I just flat told them. I said, I wouldn't accept it there when I went by myself. And I said, with you all, yeah, they'll let me in. I said, but by myself, they wouldn't. And I'm sure management has probably changed, but, you know, that was an incident. And, you know, as far as feeling angry about it, you know, I was disappointed in the way that I was treated, but I learned something from that, and I think sometimes you can learn things that are more profitable than getting angry and upset. Now, it can cause you to go to action, as like, say, that fourth time with the rental property, but, you know, I wondered, I said, here, this is my fourth time, and I didn't consider myself a radical. Didn't even consider myself a civil rights person at the time, but I said, now, if I'm as conservative as I am, been denied, four times, and only doing it one out of four times reporting it. I wonder how many other people, you know, experience the same thing. And when I was with the Human Rights Commission, we did start to investigate some of the complaints in housing and employment. We had very few in education. And I did find out that there were some racism occurring. And as a matter of fact, I remember one case, again, I investigated. And again, it was owned by a group of people. And I suppose it's all right to use a name. But Rick Starks, he was seeking a house. And during that time, there was a group of people who were denying him a house. And I had him, because I had been through the experience, I told him what type of documentation we need. And at that time, the state had a pool of testers. And see, Bowling Green didn't have a pool of testers, white testers, and black testers to go back, because in order to establish your case, you had to make sure it wasn't simply because that maybe you came after somebody or whatever. Because in some cases, I'm sure there were some property that was rented before a person got there, you know. But in order to prove it, you had to prove that it was available and then denied to you strictly because of race and not because of something else. So we contacted a couple, it was a local couple here, to go, white couple, and they checked on the same property and then came back and they wrote out their report, and then we had them to go back, and it was available when the Starks's went initially, and then they were denied, and then they said it had been rented, and then the white couple went, it was available. And then it wasn't, you know. So we got them on that, and after documenting, they made a, you know, settlement too. Again, offering them the right, you know, to live there. But that opened my eyes too, that there were still some segments around Bowling Green that were not open. And after, and like I say, this is my perception, seems like after GM came, there were less reports. Now, I wasn't actually involved full-time in the commission. I had some other things I was doing too, and in the housing, but they did make reports on how many cases of discrimination were related to housing, education, and employment, and it seems like the numbers did decrease, and whether people refused to report it or whatever, there was some of those factors, but it did seem like it went down after that. But there were some incidents, and like I say, I think they made me stronger and made me aware more than anything else. Try not to let some things excite me and get me mad, but some things do. And I guess I was disappointed in anything else, because it had destroyed the image that I had of Bowling at the time. But like, since then, there have been some, a lot of good people. It seems like Bowling has accepted it, whether they wanted to, for economic reasons or what. One thing related to that case, I was still teaching, and the daughter of one of the gentlemen whose initial contact, he was a contact person, came to me during the time of the investigation and said, why are you treating my dad and mom like that? Are you treating them unfairly? You're causing them to be sued? And I said, no, honey. I said, there's some particulars of the case. I said, you're not an adult. I can't discuss it with you. I said, but then you should ask your parents to explain it to you. And I wasn't sure that they would. But I said, I'm not at liberty to discuss the case with you because you're a minor, and then two, because you're not directly involved. But I wanted to explain to the child that, yes, your parents were guilty of discrimination along with some other families. But being the position I was in, you know, I couldn't. And now that was, I had to hassle with that because I just wanted to tell her to enlighten her, but I didn't for the ethics of it and so on. And the position I was with her was teacher to student, and I couldn't let that cross over, and that could be hard too.
Well, thank you for your time.
Well, you're more than welcome.